And what a joy to present our guest, who is very well balanced in his life between being a mathematician and a musician. We are very pleased to have with us today Associate Professor Benjamin Kennedy, who is working in the Department of Mathematics in Gettysburg College, which is in Pennsylvania, and we will be talking about this college and life of this college, a bit of a history. But now I wanted to welcome just a delightful guest, Associate Professor Benjamin Kennedy. I will take a privilege and allow myself to call this very distinguished guest just by his first name, and I will explain later why. Ben is welcome.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
I will make just a little explanation why I jumped without your permission by calling you first name, just by your first name, is because I know this truly delightful, very gifted young man for a number of years. He happened to be a very good friend of my son. And I was quite fascinated by the development of this already very gifted teenager and him becoming such a distinguished mathematician. We will be hearing about his life with math, his own placement there. But meanwhile, I wanted to congratulate you, Ben, because I always was admiring you, and it's not a compliment, it's really the way I feel that you found peace in math and peace in music. It merged, and we will be hearing a few other songs of yours. But for now, I will let you talk. And let's start from just a general question. Why math?
Well, I think it's a good question. And I think there are some things that about it that are just intellectually very attractive. And I think probably the thing that I like the most about it, and that a lot of people who do it, I think, really enjoy about it, is that when you find something that's true in mathematics, it's true beyond question. It is, you know, that the truths we talk about in mathematics are not subject to convention or field work or texts or even experimental work. They're absolutely true, and that is in some sense, gives one a sense of great security when one is studying it. And of course, also, it's just beautiful. And there, when you are studying mathematics, you come across a lot of surprising facts that just fascinate you and allow you to. And allow you little opportunities every day to be astonished. What I especially like is even for me, when I come to understand those astonishing things, that sense of wonder that I first feel on seeing them never really goes away. Let me give you an example of a surprising fact that, if you think about it for a while, makes sense, but is still really, really lovely. May I do that?
Well, absolutely.
Yes. So here's something to think about. I'm going to start adding numbers together, and I will start with 1, and then I will add 1/2, and then I will add 1/4, and then I will add 1/8, and so on. 1/16, 1/32. I'm adding a smaller number each time. Now, as I add all those numbers over and over again, the total that I get will slowly get a little bigger each time, but the total will never exceed 2. You know, 1 plus 1 half plus 1 quarter, I'm adding a smaller number each time, the total will never exceed 2. Now, suppose instead I begin with 1, I add 1 half, I add 1 third, I add 1 fourth, then 1 fifth, then 1 sixth, then 1 seventh, and so on. The number I get that way will get bigger and bigger and bigger, and will eventually be bigger than 100, eventually be bigger than 1,000, eventually be bigger than 1,000,000. So why should it be, when I'm adding a smaller number each time, in this second case, they get bigger and bigger and bigger? I think that's a beautiful fact. And it's something that, even though I've taught my students enough times about it, that I now understand it pretty well, still strikes me as very stimulating.
I am so beautifully overwhelmed. And forgive me for being clumsy with my question, but I will be totally sincere. I have to tell you that I'm very thankful that you prepared me for this example, because when you sent me some emails and you gave me some flavor of these progressions and the beauty of this logic, I probably didn't understand more than number 2 on scale of 10. So now you are making certain progress with me, because even though my fraction of understanding still is very limited, but at least I can understand conceptually. I can understand the beauty of logic of it, how creative it is, and yet it can be measured by the numbers. So just be totally honest and tell me, is something in math can be measured, which can be philosophically immeasurable?
Well, yes, there are, it is known that there are things you can say in some branches of mathematics, or questions you can ask, I should say, in some branches of mathematics that you cannot answer. And that is a philosophical point, I find it sort of troubling, right? But there are questions you can ask that have answers, but we cannot find the answers. Now, of course, there are also a lot of questions we can ask that we haven't found the answers to because we haven't figured it out yet. But there are also questions that we can ask where we will never find the answers. And that is a difficult concept, I think. I think another bit of philosophical rumination that I think you have to do sometimes when you are doing mathematics is the question of whether or not what we are doing is discovering things or inventing things. And I think I generally think of myself as discovering things and not inventing things. But it is a question. Are we making things up as we progress? You know, all the world is full of mathematicians. Are we making things up as we progress, or are we uncovering, as if we were on an archaeological dig? Are we uncovering structure that's out there by itself, independent of us? The answer does not really matter to me in my working life, but I do find myself thinking about it from time to time.
I will make a little parallel because you make me to think about certain things which I would not think otherwise. I'm sure the same process goes with your students and with our listeners. I was thinking, coming closer to my environment, and the parallel and example I like to make with music by Bach, because zillions years ago, when I was a student, we've been taught, and it sounds quite limited, but then with the years, with the progression of my own knowledge and et cetera, I found a great deal of truth of what I'm trying to tell you, relating to what you just said, that Bach really did not discover did not invent anything. He did not do anything new. He just almost rediscovered and he put together what was done before him. And he did it in such a masterful, nearly completed way that centuries after him had endless opportunities and endless food for thought and creativity. So here we have in that somewhat, I would say, harmonious contradiction when a giant in music history would be almost a little bit condemned that he did not produce anything new and just put together what was already existed before him. But I think in some sense, it's quite extraordinary to use and nearly maximize what you know and what you can maybe rediscover and bring it to another level, even if it is not a completely new dimension or new discovery.
Well, and I think, of course, for Bach is a wonderful example for thinking about whether that kind of, I mean, you talked about it almost being a condemnation, right? In my view, if you're going to, the question that comes up is, can we possibly regard that as a condemnation when we say that about someone like Bach, who blended emotion and intellect in his music in this staggering way? If that is what it means to have summed up what came before him, you know, if that's an accurate description of what he was doing, well, then I think that exalts the act of summing up rather than denigrates what he accomplished.
Absolutely. My goodness, you have such a language that makes me really coming back to you, to your life, to your roots, and to understand a little bit more where all this knowledge, eloquence, and wisdom coming from. And of course, you've been born with this fantastic package and perception of the world. That's very hard to learn. You get experience, but it has to be built on something. I personally was always incredibly impressed with your sense of articulation, with your sense of responsibility, how to say things. You've been incredible communicator. I believe that somehow you overcame this teen shyness, and you always created a very convincing presence of yourself. With all this glamorization, let me go to the basic of your education. Can I?
Yes, absolutely.
So I'll
sit here and blush while you ask your question.
Oh, that is no, that's exactly the purpose of it. So enjoy the process. I met you at the Commonwealth School, which is one of the finest school in the country. And I'm not saying this because you went there and my son went there, but because it is. After that, you actually had your interesting education because you moved from New England. Not completely, I should correct myself. You had a taste of Boston College, but then you moved from New England. You've been part of Swarthmore College, which you graduated. And then you went to Rutgers University as an advisor of, I believe it's Roger Nussbaum for the thesis. Yes, your PhD, basically. I said it in a little bit clumsy way. Now, I know Rutgers, happen to know pretty well because I was part of it for a number of years. And I wanted to ask you, not much in details, but how was your experience doing this thesis in PhDs in mathematics? Was it really first major taste of math? Was it truly a forming years for your future activities?
It was for me, yes, because it was really the problems that I was working on as a graduate student were the first new math problems I had solved. I mean, every mathematician at some point in his or her education will solve at some point or do some work that no one else has done. Everybody has to, and it's part of what a working mathematician does. And so that experience was very important to me and very exciting to me. And it was just a sense of real delight that I could think about something for, I guess it was about 3 years that I was actively working on my thesis, and that I could get somewhere. Of course, when I remember actually writing it down, it's blended in my mind with the birth of my son, and my son was born as I was writing my thesis, and my first son. And this turned out to be a wonderful arrangement because I was sitting at home writing, and I could concentrate on my mathematics for perhaps 15 minutes at a time. And my baby was on a 2-hour cycle of eating and sleeping and things. So when he was down and quiet, I could do some mathematics, and then he'd wake up and burble around. So I would fuss with him and change him and feed him, and then go back and work some more. And I know that that's not an available. I know that's not an option for every young, you know, graduate student writing a thesis. But if you can work it so that you're writing a thesis right when you have a baby, it's a wonderful way to stay, contemplative and balanced as you work.
You find creativity just in anything. And that makes life, I do not want to simplify and say easier, no. But I would say that it makes somewhat a diffusion. It's almost constant process. You don't have time to some kind of almost a destruction. You find that continuity of the quality. It sounds a little technical, but I believe that probably one of the beauty in your character and passion for math, which perhaps prepared you to receive your first child. And we will talk about your truly beautiful family because I happen to know your wife. And in this extremely complex, tense world, your marriage, one of the very, very rare union, which is breathing through such a fantastic devotion, emotion, talents, and certainly, tremendous gift for your children. And all of these things I'm saying because they are. I'm not trying to ask you to feel uncomfortable because I know you're a very modest person, but that's really the truthful experience when people meet you, and I was one of them. I like to propose now, Ben, to shift a little bit into your music world, and I need to catch up, and I need to tell to our listeners that we opened our program actually with your playing, and you played for us the song which is titled As a Hard Times by Paul Mitchell. I like for us to listen to another song, and after that we will dedicate a little bit time to your musical world. Is that all right with you?
Yes, certainly.
All right, then we are going to listen to Diana. That's the name of another song. And the performer at this point, I should say, not a mathematician, but a pianist, our fantastic guest, Associate Professor of Gettysburg College, Benjamin Kennedy. Apology, we had some kind of a little bit of a confusion here in terms of receiving your material, so I have to change the announcement of the song. That was Mean to Me by Fred Alert and Ro Turk. Please do a better job in pronouncing the title of the name, Ben.
Oh, Fred Allard and Rory Turk.
Okay, but is it Mean to Me?
Mean to Me, yes.
Mean to Me. I do regret that we will not hear Diana this time. I don't know exactly what took place, but this digital unpredictability sometimes makes things a little bit difficult. So let's talk about your musical life. And let's talk a little bit about these songs and your relationship with music and piano.
Sure. So, my musical life is It's mostly personal. I'm not a professional musician. I'm an avocational musician, if that. But it's been a daily part of my life for many years now. And I view it as an emotional activity. And people do sometimes ask me about mathematics and music and about the relationship between the two. And there is one certainly, and I think for a lot of people who do both, that relationship is very overt. But for me, the mathematics is much more austere and intellectual, and music is just fun.
And they really, they almost, frankly, add into each other, because regardless how emotional music is, there is still some organization, even if it is intuitively, but you certainly aware what you're doing, the style, there's some pulse, there's some rhythmical things. So I found that this... if you're feeling comfortable in one thing, you somehow will find the comfort in another thing if you love it. So I felt that your improvisation is frankly quite inventive. And the fact that you can improvise gives you that tremendous emotional independence. It's a precious gift. How many songs do you have? Is it a heritage? Is it recorded? Where can we hear you?
Oh, there are some recordings, but no, I am not. Where can I be heard? Not many places, I'm afraid. Mostly my house. But I do, when the opportunity arises, I love to play with friends, and it's always something, yes, that I love to share with them and with my family. I grew up making music from time to time, not daily, but from time to time with my family, which is where I first learned to enjoy it. And my sister, whom I still make music with whenever I have the opportunity, is a very talented singer and has the kind of ears that can hear grass grow, you know, these sort of amazing ears. And so it's always a special privilege for me to play with her. So this is for me a daily but informal arrangement.
I think it's a tremendous opportunity to share this with your children and to feel that you're music part of life, because we're living in a society where, unfortunately, for example, classical music or even some beautiful old jazz, not as popular as it should have been. It's some kind of mistakenly considered to be performed by elite or for elite. It's for people. And I'm so thrilled that you do have this as a part of life, because this is sometimes even easier to formulate when you do not need to speak. You do not need to really be responsible for anything else, but just to express yourself. And that's a fantastic attribute and tremendous environmental moments, again, in our very stressful life. I like to come back to your math. And actually, Julian is making a very good suggestion here. He's bringing the issue of your specialty in math, which is dynamical system. Now, it sounds somewhat mysterious, and I will let you to give us a little tour in your specialty. But meanwhile, I wanted to make sure that our listeners are aware of the fact that we are having a very interesting guest, Associate Professor of Gettysburg College, Benjamin Kennedy, who is kind enough to share with us all spectrums of his life, from math to music, from music to his family. And now we're coming back to math, to his prime profession. And I just wanted to let everyone know that Ben already had a taste of different part of the world. He was with his presentation in Germany, in Hungary. His voice was heard in Utah several times. He has some invited presentations in quite other interesting places, which I wanted to ask you about. And this additional note, Ben, stage is yours. Let's talk about your dynamical system.
Sure. I love to talk about this. So I think what dynamical systems is the study of rules for how quantities change over time. That's basically what the discipline is about. And one of the so I let me give you a little bit of a history of this. Many of the early mathematicians working in this area were interested in understanding things like the motions of the planets. And once we understood some physics, Newtonian physics, we could write down rules for how, if I know, say, where all of the planets in the solar system are now, I know how they are moving. I know the direction they're moving right now. If I kind of know where they are and what they've been doing lately, so I can sort of talk about what they're going to do in the very short term. Now, for a long time, well, let me go to around the late 1800s with a mathematician, a French mathematician, Henri Poincaré. And he realized that trying to come up with a formula for where all these things, say these planets, were going to be in the future was impossible or too hard or impossible. So something that he realized he could do was that he could draw a lot of conclusions about how the planets were going to move, qualitative conclusions, without actually having a formula for where exactly they were going to be at all the time. And this approach really has borne fruit beginning in the last half of the 20th century, when mathematicians began to realize that even when they could not write down formulas for how the quantities they were interested in were going to behave, by which I mean, by a formula, I mean, you tell me the time on the clock that you're interested in, 1 hour in the future, 2 hours in the future, and then I can tell you exactly where each planet will be, say. Even without those formulas, I can describe a lot about how the planets will move. And one thing which has been extremely exciting since computers became widely available is that we're able to experiment and see all these phenomena that are very, very striking. And one particularly exciting phenomenon that many of your listeners may have heard about is so-called chaos. And it happens that even when you have a very simple rule governing how something is going to, how a quantity is going to change in the short term, the long-term behavior of the quantity can be very complicated and very unpredictable. And so this is kind of a staggering thing to see. funnily enough, one of the early examples of such a chaotic system was discovered by a meteorologist. We all think of the weather as unpredictable, right? But this was a meteorologist named Edward Lorenz in the, I suppose it would have been the late 50s, early 60s. And he found, he wrote down some fairly simple rules for how a particular idealized weather system would behave. And he noticed that even though the rules were not that complicated, the behavior of a weather system following these rules could be fantastically complicated. And that is very, very stimulating. And he also found that if you changed things a little bit, a small change now could lead to enormous changes in the future. This has since been come to be known as the butterfly effect, right? A butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil can cause a tornado here, that sort of thing. But this phenomenon of these small changes giving rise to large and unpredictable changes is just very beautiful and very intriguing. And the systems that I study sometimes display this kind of complexity, and sometimes they don't. And either way, you've got something fun to study, because the complexity is mystifying and fun to study, and the simpler behavior is actually easier to understand and easier to prove things about often. So that can be very gratifying to look at also. But that's what dynamical systems is about. And I will say one more thing. I will give an example closer to my own work that your listeners can play with at home, which is that the systems that I study, imagine that you have some sort of regulatory mechanism operating with a delay. And the best example is somebody in the shower. So imagine you get in the shower, and the water is too cold. So what do? You twist the knob to make the water hotter, right? But if you twist the knob too far, you won't know it right away, because the water has to go through the pipe from where you twisted the knob up, out the shower head. It's got to fly through the air and hit you on the skin. So it's possible to turn the knob too far, because you only sense the temperature water with a delay. So then what do? You twist the knob the other way, and it goes, and then it might be a little too cold, because you don't know it's too cold until you've twisted the knob too far. And then you twist the knob back, and if you're patient, eventually you will find the right level. But that going back and forth between too hot and too cold gives us a slogan, which is that delays can induce oscillation. And that's something that really we have begun to understand a lot better in the last, say, 40 or 50 years, delays inducing oscillation in systems that regulate themselves. So that's a fascinating area to study.
Certainly, I have my thoughts next time I go to the shower. And you actually provoked me in something which I wasn't sure whether I should bring it up or not. So since you gave such a broad and yet very concrete, fascinating journey of math with a relationship with life, I like to bring something which I found very fascinating. But if it is beyond your expertise or beyond your conceptual comprehension. We just will leave it with that. But I'm sure you will give us some kind of comments. Nobel Prize winner Paul Mansfield was a specialist. Actually, he is a specialist in on MRI. But in parallel to this, he actually was credited with showing how the radio signals from MRI can be mathematically analyzed, making interpretation of the signals into useful image a possibility. Is that something you can comment on?
I really cannot, I'm afraid. I have heard enough people explain to me a little bit of it that I know that it is a fascinating problem and a difficult problem, but I am not an expert in that.
The reason actually I brought this up to pick up on your extremely broad, virtually endless vision and endless connection between world of math and world of life. And when I learned about that, I was truly fascinated, and I was thinking about your research and about what you're doing. And I said to myself, we are having a discussion, and this is just another point to see what a phenomenal field you're in, that it is truly with endless connections. I like to shift into your teaching world, if you do not mind, because I'm unfortunately looking at the time, and I'd rather to have more of a sense of timing with you, but time is unfortunately conducting our life as well. So I'd like to talk how you finding yourself with the students. What is your most preferable group of students, the graduates or undergraduates? What is your style, and how would you find the student body today, as I mentioned a few times, in quite a complicated world? I know I pose many questions, but just choose whatever is a part of your life.
Sure. I mean, so I teach, as you have mentioned, when you introduced me, at Gettysburg College. This is an undergraduate-only college. It's a liberal arts college. So I teach undergraduates, and they are a delight. You asked about the students whom I like to work with most. I think the answer is the students who are interested, you know, whether they are, and fortunately here many students are interested, whether they're studying mathematics or whether they are just taking a mathematics course in service of something else they're studying. You know, when you find a student who is interested, those are the students who teach you also. And so I'm always hoping to learn when I talk to these students. As far as what I want them to get, of course, someone who's studying mathematics, I want them to learn mathematics. But more generally, I want students, and this is one of the reasons why I think every student should study mathematics, to experience what it's like to approach a problem with a mathematical turn of mind. And what I mean by that is that it's important when somebody is learning mathematics, because mathematics is hard and it takes a long time to figure things out. It's important that somebody believe that it's possible to move from not understanding to understanding using one's mind. And, of course, with help, you know, with help from others, from instructors, and from peers. But the student whom I feel I have been successful with is the student who knows that even if they do not understand something at all now, that if they think carefully 1 week, 2 weeks, a month, a year from now, they might understand it. And that it is possible to think about a question and actually arrive at an unambiguous answer, a solution, something that you know is correct. And so that's what I really try to show, and I hope for my students, that they can learn that not understanding at the moment is not the end of the world. Being stuck is part of problem solving, but that it's really possible to make progress just by thinking about something for long enough.
I hear so much of wisdom, but I also hear a gift for teaching, Ben, because needless to mention that you have a patience and compassion, but you almost feel as if you're walking through somebody else's mind, where you can make student not only feel confident, but you engaging student in this extremely interesting process, when you turning tedious process into exciting process. And I guess the word is the process. I do not need to mention to you that today we are living in a mentality of quick fix and all this sometimes falsely dynamic society. So I wanted to thank you also for myself as a teacher for a number of years, that you do have this ability, desire, and devotion to make person think. And through thinking process, you're actually building the character. This is tremendous. And
I think that actually in the question of thinking as it relates to character is a central one, because I feel that not even mathematicians are perfect. I'll admit that, right? But if everybody, or if you have a habit of mind that says you will do your best to not accept or use bad logic, and that you will genuinely question whether or not something has really been answered, whether you really know something, I think there's a mix of intellectual humility and intellectual rigor, which comes from thinking through difficult problems, that can make you a positive contributor to your world if you think carefully and really try to let your intellect be a guide in how you think through problems. And I don't know anybody who lives up to that ideal all the time. I certainly don't. But it is important that we get all the practice we can.
And in this very enlightening thought, we would have to put some cadenza in this very, very interesting conversation. Ben, I wanted to thank you for your sharing. I wanted to thank you for who you are, for your successes, literally in every level, even though you're not trying almost as hard as you think you should. But for now, result is just phenomenal. And I hope that we just started our dialogue. And with all of this, I wish you, your truly beautiful family, a wonderful year. And I hope that we will reconnect before too long. And I will conclude in saying that we had very special guest, associate professor of Gettysburg College, Department of Mathematics, Benjamin Kennedy. And on this note, I wanted to thank you for being with us.
I've had a wonderful time, Elena. It's wonderful to speak to you, and thank you very much.
Pleasure is all ours. On this note, I wanted to remind you that you being part of Lena Life. I'm Lena Mirmont with wishes for BBS and their handsome engineers. I will see you next week with a very interesting and informative show regarding medicine. Be well, and whoever in the East Coast, be brave to deal with the winter. Whoever is enjoying warmer weather, just enjoy life for all of us. Until then.